From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Jay Stevens. His book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream, examines the psychedelic movement in the 1960s, its origins, and its legacy. Also today, I talk with stop-motion animator Phil Tippett. He's brought to life the Pillsbury Doughboy, the Imperial Walkers in the Star Wars movies, and police robot Ed 209 in the movie RoboCop. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Pickles and Peppers, an album of rags composed by women, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says in France, the dictionary teaches you more than the language. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Twenty years ago, during what's been called the Summer of Love, thousands of young people from around the country gathered in San Francisco, the capital of the counterculture. The hippie sacrament, which was widely available in California, was the psychedelic drug LSD. My guest Jay Stevens has written a history of LSD. Its role in the rise and fall of the counterculture is only part of the story. Stevens traces the history of this synthetic drug from its creation in 1943. He describes the LSD experiments conducted in the 1950s by the psychiatric profession and the CIA. And he looks at the people who first began experimenting with the drug as a way to alter consciousness. It wasn't until 1962 that the Food and Drug Administration began to regulate the use of LSD. Stevens calls 1966 the year America woke to the gravity of the psychedelic movement. That year, three congressional committees investigated LSD, and California passed a bill criminalizing the drug. Jay Stevens' new book is titled Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. It's published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. I spoke to him earlier today from the NPR studios in New York. I wanted to know if it was difficult to research the subject of LSD, considering how underground its usage has been.
The real answer is probably yes or no. It was difficult in the sense that the people that were involved with it are fairly closed-mouthed about it now because it ended so badly, and they're scattered widely. Many of them, many of the people that were involved in the 50s, the therapeutic community, are now in their 70s or 80s. So in that sense, you had to travel around, you had to dig them out, you had to, in a sense, gain their trust and be passed along.
And yeah, people think you were a narcotics agent when you came questioning them?
No, a couple did. Yes. Most of them really felt that they had been so misrepresented, certainly the early therapists and the hippie leadership. They had been misrepresented, and so they were suspicious. You came in with the black mark of a reporter on you, and you sort of had to say, well, prove to us that you're a nice guy. And once they'd sort of vetted you, then they'd say, oh, well, you must talk to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, and that's really the way it went around. It was easy in one sense because a lot of people involved with it really felt that they were involved with a story that was one of the major ones of the 20th century, let's say, a peculiar story about really an attempt to explore man's unconscious and possibly get in touch with this, higher spirituality. And so they kept everything. There was a man, Oscar Janiger, a psychiatrist close to the Huxley crowd. Early in the 60s, he decided that what he was involved with was a resounding story, and so he began tape recording everyone. And so you had these archives that a lot of people kept. Kesey kept everything, every scrap of every napkin that they ever wrote on in an acid test is in his archives. Leary had people around him that were assiduous archivists. And this kind of helped because the nature of the story, taking a lot of psychedelic drugs in the 60s, one of the downsides of the drug is sort of a problem with short-term memory.
That's right.
So in terms of being a historian, it was really helpful that there were the archivists out there.
You're 32, so I figure you came of age at the tail end of the psychedelic period. What was your personal interest in researching the subject of LSD?
Well, I came of age at the end of the 60s with its shadow sort of on me, and I was always fascinated by the period, and I really wanted to write a book, and through a number of circumstances, suddenly I focused on the psychedelic movement, and the more I looked at it, the more fascinating and interesting it became. One reason was because the story I thought I knew was not what had happened at all, really. I had sort of absorbed a number of myths and rumors, and that was not really what had happened. And then as it, you know, where, what other story could you have? God, the CIA, G. Gordon Liddy, Tim Leary, the hippies, Harvard professors, all sort of crowding in between the margins. I fell in love with the story.
Did you feel that as part of your research you had to either do LSD for the first time, or if you'd done it before, do it again and get a direct sense of the experience?
Yeah, I sort of felt, I mean, that you couldn't write about China without going there. And when I started doing, I had done probably a lot of my generation, I had tried these drugs in the early 70s, and I took them in a fairly, you know, you'd go look at the ocean or you'd go to a rock concert, somebody would say, here's a pill, take this. And at that time, you actually did. You look back on it now and you're a little horrified of all the things you put in your system. But anyways, I had done it then. And when I started researching the book, a number of the psychotherapists involved with it in the 50s sort of said, you know, you have to take this drug and you let us show you what we used to do with it. You know, let us, I mean, if you read the therapeutic literature, there were claims made that, you know, they could take you to areas of experience that looked like past lives, or, you know, the classic one, you know, to the pure void, the cosmic meaning at the center of all. You could wander into that room. Leary called the mind that you found under LSD the land of 10,000 rooms. And a lot of these guys said, hey, we have maps. We can tour you around. And
well, would you describe what that trip was like, or the series of trips which you took with the guidance of some of the people who were leading the trips back in the early days of psychedelic drugs?
This was one of the, I mean, we can talk about content. We'll talk about, I guess, let's talk a little bit about the form. One of the problems that psychedelic therapy had within the therapeutic community was because of the way a guided trip looked like. What they would do is usually they would mask all the senses because they want you to go inside. They want you to go into your unconscious. And so they would mask all the senses. They would usually start off with their certain pieces of music by Bach that when you hear them, you realize, you know, this man was writing about a mystical experience. I mean, it seems implicit in the music. And that kind of carries you up. Gets you into the state, and then, you know, they guide you with pictures. There is one moment they bring out a clear diamond, a pure diamond, and you look into the diamond, and the only way to describe it is you sort of leap over, leap across the canyon, and you're into another area of the unconscious. If you start having problems, there are various tactile things that they do that's very calming. What it's very similar to, actually, is what might be called classic shamanic technique. And this was a problem for the therapists in the late 50s when they started saying, I don't know why blowing smoke in the face of a person who's having problems with this drug works, but it works. Or I don't know why this picture of Goya's some of Van Gogh. Van Gogh, had a little bit of this state. Why looking at these flowers will move them into a different area of the mind, but it does. And so, using a lot of these peculiar cues, they could sort of move you around. Say, well, let's go see what's in your personal unconscious, and you're back there, sort of experiencing something that happened to you when you were two.
Well, very briefly, did this experience that you had put you in the right frame of mind to continue the research on your book about LSD?
Sure. It made me... Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the research that you've done and some of the history that you've uncovered. LSD was first synthesized in 1943 by a research chemist named Dr. Albert Hofmann working in Switzerland. What was he trying to create?
He was looking for, well, in the early days of the pharmaceutical industry, they were looking for anything that would work, but he was specifically looking for a migraine headache cure, something for headaches, a pain reliever. And he was working with Ergo that had proved that they'd gotten a number of drugs out of it, and so he was continuing that project. And he discovered LSD.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Jay Stevens, and he's just written a history of LSD. It's called Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. LSD entered American culture through two very different areas. One is through psychiatry, which was using it as a therapeutic tool, and the other was through the CIA, which was using it in experiments. Let's talk about psychiatry, and then we'll get to the CIA. What were some of the uses that in the early 50s psychiatrists saw for LSD?
Well, there were really two schools. The first school, which in a sense, if you think about it, are connected. LSD was really seen as psychotherapy had finally found the key into the unconscious. It unlocked that locked door, and you could go in and rummage around. Now, certain people thought that the unconscious, well, what happened when you got there is it was the location of crazy behavior. So one group of therapists and researchers mainly used it to create what they called psychotic breakdowns. They really thought, this is a drug where we can use it to make people experimentally crazy, and we'll discover what craziness is. And so you had these people using it to drive people crazy in laboratory situations, and they called it a psychotomimetic. LSD in the early literature was known as a psychotomimetic. Another group of therapists, though, were using it because they discovered that if you gave somebody a small amount of LSD and then you started them through the very traditional therapeutic sort of questioning, they seemed to have access to their unconscious fears, their anxieties. They seemed to get there a lot faster. So they thought, we're looking at something that will speed up the therapeutic process. You'd have people saying, a lot of papers were written where therapists said, I did in 3 months what used to take me 3 years. So those were the two uses within the therapeutic community. Now, do you want to get to the CIA?
Yeah, no. The CIA started experimenting with it in around 1953. What were they trying to do?
The CIA had inherited from the Nazis, and, well, I suppose all of the intelligence agencies around the country, around the world, had really started looking for a mind control drug. And the CIA was very energetically examining all kinds of possibilities, and when I think they were first attracted not to the therapeutic possibilities of LSD but to the madness possibilities, when they said, here's a drug that'll temporarily drive people crazy, they thought, possibly this is a drug that will allow us to control their minds as well. So they were, very early on got onto the psychedelic family of drugs and sort of paralleled the therapy community in their search for it. They used psilocybin, mescaline, all kinds of substances in their search.
Well, in a moment, I want to talk to you about some of the people who brought LSD out of experimentation into American culture. But first, we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Jay Stevens. He's the author of the new book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jay Stevens is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. Jay, let's talk about three of the people who you compare, three of the people who helped popularize LSD. Aldous Huxley, the writer, Timothy Leary, who started off as a, a professor at Harvard University, and Ken Kesey, who was a novelist who played a big role in popularizing the drug. Let's start with Huxley. He started experimenting with LSD in 1953. What was his vision of what LSD could do?
Huxley really felt he was the best way to put it is Aldous Huxley was heir to a desire among a lot of Western intellectuals dating back to about the 1880s that a way could be found to accelerate human evolution. Now, what's that mean? To Huxley, it didn't mean, and to most of the people that bought into this belief, it didn't mean that you'd get taller or anything like that. They really believed you'd get more conscious. As a matter of fact, the phrase cosmic consciousness was coined in 1900 to sort of indicate the evolutionary stage beyond self-consciousness. And it was coined by a Canadian, Richard Buck, and he really felt that people like Buddha and Jesus and a number of the other great mystics were merely like species forerunners of cosmic consciousness. Now, Huxley bought into this about the 30s, and he really felt that, particularly after World War I and very greatly after the discovery of atomic fission, that a way had to be found to accelerate human evolution. And he really spent from about 1930 to 1953 a lot of his time went for searching for a way to get access to this cosmic dimension that the great mystics seemed to have access to.
Through his writing, he made some of the intellectuals aware of mm-hmm. these kinds of drugs. Let's compare his view to Timothy Leary's, who played a greater role in democratizing LSD and making it available to larger groups of people.
Well, Aldous ran into mescaline and then LSD in the early 50s. And, okay, here you've had a desire to accelerate human evolution, and you've discovered what you think might be the appropriate tool. What do you do? Huxley really felt what you did is you turned on the cultural, political, and scientific elite of the world, that these were the people that really changed cultures, that led people in new directions. And so he really spent the last 10 years of his life trying to interest these people in taking it and sort of trying to get people to research the spiritual aspects of it. And Tim Leary was, in a sense, I mean, if you want to use a crude word, recruited by the Huxley crowd, because Tim was at Harvard and a lot of members of the world elite passed through Harvard in any given year. Now, Tim differed on how you might change a culture or change man's evolutionary curve. Tim really felt you didn't turn on older people that had their categories intact. What you did is you turned on the kids. You turned on the people who were still open to all life's possibilities. He also felt that everybody should be able to have this experience. Not, you know, you didn't need a PhD from Harvard in order to take LSD, that everybody should be able to take them, provided you were carefully guided. Tim would recognize that, you know, going into your unconscious could be very dangerous, so you needed a guide. And so Tim really said, well, you know, we will train guides, and every young American can have this experience. He'll just call up his neighborhood guide, look him up in the Yellow Pages, psychedelic guide, call him up and say, I want to take a trip.
Well, you suggest that Ken Kesey, with the trips festivals, and with his wide dissemination of LSD, took away some of those controls, and maybe by doing so made it more possible for people to have bad trips.
Yes. What really happened was the Huxley people were horrified when Tim sort of ran away in his direction, and Tim really felt everybody could have a good trip provided they were carefully guided. Ken Kesey really felt that controls weren't the point. They got in the way. The point was to freak freely, as they used to put it, to sort of like, can you pass the acid test? It was a very macho ethic, really. You know, can you go and hang over the edge by your toes and not fall in a sense? And he also felt that it was he saw the party aspect to it. All these other people were, you know, even the Leary people were sort of running around, still in the spiritual aspect. Kesey, you know, really saw the party aspect, and he began throwing increasingly large parties where, you can see that's a these two philosophies sort of met, and I think the meeting of them was disastrous. Tim's sort of saying, everybody can take this drug, everybody should take this drug, and Ken Kesey sort of saying, you don't need any controls to do it. Take it and have fun, and if you go crazy, well, you didn't pass the acid test. And that sort of was the making of a lot of the badness that came out in the late 60s.
Where do you think that the whole psychedelic dream started to go bad?
I think it started to go bad in late 66, probably. I think that it had, you know, I start my book with the gathering of the tribes for the first human being, and that was sort of, in a sense, that's the climax of my book. I go back, it's the sense, that's the highest moment, and it's all downhill from there, though it's going to take about, that was in January 67, it's going to take about till July before the people realize that, you know, they had almost grasped whatever it was they were seeking to grasp, and that they'd slipped, somehow it had eluded them. So I'd say the middle of 67, it began to go very bad for a number of reasons.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of people who were doing psychedelic drugs in the 1960s and in the early 1970s discounted a lot of the warnings that parents, government officials, and the press were giving.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason why I think they were discounted was because they were extreme warnings, and also because the warnings were given from people who didn't understand at all why people were doing these drugs in the first place. Do you think that that's a fair assessment?
I think that's absolutely correct. One of the curious things about the area of anti-drug, I don't want to say propaganda, but in a sense, that's sort of what it is. And you can go back to start and look at the Reefer Madness stuff of the 30s.
Well, people used to get stoned and go watch that movie. That was supposed to be a cautionary film about
that
marijuana.
That was a cautionary film.
That was
film.
Really how it was used as a source of entertainment.
If you read a lot of the Reefer Madness stuff, it was, okay, smoke a joint and you'll rape your sister and kill your mother and then commit suicide. And all anyone had to do when they started doing it in the 50s was smoke one joint and see that that didn't happen and sort of say, hey, this isn't bad. And, you know, the whole anti-message was lost. My feeling was that, you know, they weren't straight with the kids. And in a sense, what you had in the late 60s was two propaganda wars. You had Tim Leary saying, take LSD and you'll have 10,000 orgasms. And you had the establishment, or whatever you want to call it, the cultural powers that be saying, if you take this drug, you'll go crazy. And what happened was a lot of kids seemed to be saying, if what you have is sane, then give me crazy. So they escalated the battle, and within the propaganda war, when they came up with the genetic damage argument, which was, perhaps you've heard of that, that if you took LSD, it would damage your chromosomes. Within the scientific community, that was widely belittled, the actual research protocol, the way the guy designed his experiment. But, you know, at the sort of media surface of things at Time Life, New York Times, it was given, you know, it was given wide play. And I think that in that sense, they won the media game, because the idea that to take the risk yourself was one thing. To pass it down through the generations, it was sort of a very cool wind that swept through the psychedelic movement. Also because, let me give you another reason, the hippies were very fond of the idea that they were mutants. They really bought into the whole notion that they were the evolutionary curve of the species were changing, and they were the mutated species.
The freaks.
They preferred freaks and heads. And if you've bought into that, and then somebody comes along and says, you really are, or actually your kids are going to be freaks, it came at them, and it's the last thing they expected. And you can sort of, if you go back and read the history, you can see the convulsions that went through the period.
Does anyone do LSD anymore? Is there much of it available? Is there a market for it?
Actually, the only statistics you really have, yeah, I'd say there's more LSD being used probably today. If you go by the accounts that are showing up in newspapers, than has been in the last few years. But the only way the government really has of testing these things is they give a survey to high school kids called the National Institute of Drug Abuse Survey. And the figures have been about very constant from the late 60s right up till now. About 10% of the kids in high school use psychedelics or have used them. So if that's any indication, it remains among a small group a very... still a potent force. Whether they're using them to gain access into a higher consciousness, I tend not to think so. I tend to think that they're using it like it's like a fast car.
One last question. Do you see any connection between the rise of the use of cocaine and designer drugs with the psychedelic movement of the 60s? Is there any comparison to be made?
It used to people that bought into the vision that this was going to change consciousness, when they saw the hippies in the Haight-Ashbury start using speed, start using heroin, it just blew their minds. And I think, yeah, LSD created and a lot of drugs have created an appetite for sensation, you know, and a lot of the people that use them, maybe 2 out of every 5 or 3 out of every 5 who used them back then, were simply using it, as I said earlier, it was like a fast car. Cocaine's a better sensation. I mean, LSD, you took it, you were gone 12 hours. You know, you really couldn't hold a job if you did LSD a lot. Cocaine, you can hold a job and still have a nightlife. I think that it played a part in it. It certainly got a lot of kids that wouldn't have gone in that direction into looking for more and more intense sensations.
But without the pursuit of the more mystical.
Right. Vision. I mean, in the sense of, in a pharmacological sense, I mean, cocaine and LSD are very different drugs. They do different things to the body. They have, there are different pleasures. There are different downsides involved. But in the fact that they're a drug, they're an illegal drug, and a drug subculture arose that looked at these things, they're related. And I think the cocaine epidemic that came out is one of the, you know, as Huxley would say, it's simply, you know, we haven't gone about this intelligently yet.
You did a little bit of LSD when you were younger. Do you regret it at all now? Do you regard it differently now after having written this book than you did when you were doing it at the time?
Yes and no. You know, at the time it was fun, and one of the nice things about one of the hard things about writing the book in the Just Say No generation is you run into saying, well, one of the nice things about taking LSD, and you say, my God, how is that going to sound? What are they going to think? Anyways, one of the nice things about taking LSD when you're young is suddenly the world seems alive. You know, you're looking at a tree and you're saying, whoa, that tree is really alive. And it's probably nice to do that when you're about 18 or 19, I think, to suddenly rediscover that there's nature out there, that you're living in a living world. And this is something that happens to almost everyone that did the drug. To use it sort of so foolishly, well, Huxley used to feel, and I suppose if anybody, I've come to adopt his perspective, that it was really best for people in their 30s because they, because they sort of had stable egos. They were less impassioned about life. They were sort of in the midpoint of the journey, and that was a good time to reflect upon the big question. So I don't regret it, no. But on the other hand, I sort of look back and I say, well, I didn't do it intelligently. And then yet, you know, you also say, well, when I was 19, I wasn't that intelligent anyways.
Jay Stevens, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Jay Stevens is the author of the new book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. The book is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On tomorrow's program, I'll speak with singer and guitarist Roy Bookbinder. He interprets blues and popular song from the 1920s and 30s. He'll bring his guitar and play some songs, so I hope you can join us. Here's Bookbinder's recording of Mississippi John Hurt's Keep a Knockin'.
Hey, you're knocking, but you can't come in. Keep a knocking, but you can't come in. Keep a knocking, but you can't come in. I said, I'll come back tomorrow night and try it again. You better come back tomorrow night and try it again. I know you love me, but you can't come in. I know you love me, but you can't come in. Keep a knocking, but you can't come in. Now come back tomorrow night and try it again. I said, I'll come back tomorrow night and try it again. I know you want me, but you can't come in. I know you want me, but you can't come in. Keep a knocking, but you can't come in now. Come
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, stop-motion animator Phil Tippett tells how he makes weird creatures and mechanical monsters move. He animated the Walkers in the Star Wars trilogy and the police robot Ed 209 in the movie RoboCop. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Pickles and Peppers, an anthology of 19th century rags composed by women and performed by pianist Virginia Eskin. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines all the extras you can find in the French dictionary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Women's contributions to the arts have often been overlooked. That was the case with women who wrote Ragtime, but now, almost a century later, there's an album of rags by women performed by pianist Virginia Eskin. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of the album Pickles and Peppers.
Someone says ragtime in a word association game, and you're sure to answer Scott Joplin or Irving Berlin, or maybe E.L. Doctorow. We tend to think of this irresistibly syncopated music as primarily male-originated and male-oriented, saloon or brothel music that finally went respectable. But pianist Virginia Eskin's new record on Northeastern, Pickles and Peppers, has a surprise for us. This is an album of piano rags written by women. Most of them were composed during the heyday of ragtime, between the gay or naughty 90s and World War I, and most of them are more technically complex than the rags we're more familiar with. There are also two intriguing contemporary rags by Judith Lang Zamont. The informative liner notes by Carolyn A. Lindemann point out that playing the piano at the turn of the century was primarily woman's work, and that when young middle-class women heard piano rags played in the local five and dimes by sheet music sales clerks, they bought the music, brought it home, and even began to compose. Ragtime was becoming domestic, though not completely domesticated. On Eskin's record, we find such kitchen and cupboard titles as Red Peppers, Pickles and Peppers, and Chicken Chowder, The Dusty Rag, and The Dish Rag. But then again, there's also The Thriller, with an exclamation point, by May Afterheide, and Charlotte Blake's That Poker Rag. Here's one of my favorites, Julia Lee Niebergall's Horseshoe Rag, published in 1911.
Thank you.
There were probably more women ragtime composers than we'll ever know, since many of those who felt the drive to publish had to publish under assumed names or sign the sheet music only with their initials. Most of these rags were written by gifted young women who were compelled to give up their musical ambitions in order to raise a family. Some of the composers included here remained so obscure it's been impossible to learn anything about them at all. Eskin, long an advocate of women composers, is a particularly effective advocate for these pieces. Her witty rhythmic changes, her impressive variety of touch, now boisterous and clangy, now slyly delicate, are the signs of a classical virtuoso. But most other serious musicians don't play with such freshness, such rightness of style when they turn to popular music. Pickles and Peppers is a serious record. It's the history of popular culture, it's social history, it's the history of yet one more overlooked contribution to the arts by women. There's plenty here to think about. But because the material itself is so engaging, it's also one of the most delightful records released this year. If you don't want to think, you can just sit back and enjoy.
Lloyd Schwartz is a classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed Pickles and Peppers, an album of rags by women performed by Virginia Eskin. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Phil Tippett. He's a leader in the revival of stop-motion animation. It's a technique that dates back to the early days of filmmaking, the technique that made King Kong, Mighty Joe Young, and countless monsters and dinosaurs move. It's done by manipulating three-dimensional models and filming them one frame at a time. Tippett's latest film credit is RoboCop. He animated Ed 209, the totally mechanized police robot. He also brought to life the dragon in the movie Dragon Slayer and won an Academy Award for his work in Return of the Jedi. When I spoke to Phil Tippett, he told me that ever since he was a kid, stop-motion animation was what he wanted to do.
First time I had noticed anything at all was on television in 1958, and it was an ad for a movie called The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. And I harangued my parents for weeks and weeks and weeks to take me to see the picture. And they did, and that hooked me. It was a film that was done by Charles Schneer, the producer, and Ray Harryhausen, who was the preeminent stop-motion animator throughout the 50s and 60s.
What did you love about it?
There was an unreality that was implicit in the process of stop-motion animation that I found fascinating. I guess it's the... There's a kind of a geometry or like a dance or a ballet that these inanimate objects are put through, and the process of imagining something in your mind and physically manipulating a three-dimensional object to achieve what's in your mind leaves you with a result that is almost surreal.
I'm going to ask you for a crash course on stop-motion animation. Would you describe first, when is stop-motion used?
Well, I think the best way to describe stop-motion first is to mention how it's different from cartoon animation or two-dimensional animation, which is how, you know, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck are created. And in that process, you have a number of pieces of paper with drawings on each sheet. In one frame, Donald Duck's hand might be over his head, the next frame a little bit lower, a little bit lower in the next frame, and on and on and on until you get a successive buildup of images that you shoot one frame at a time, and it creates the illusion that Donald Duck's hand is moving from the top of his head down to his waist, say. Well, in stop-motion animation, we're working with a three-dimensional model. So when you're moving the creature, say the arm, you move it, position it a tiny fraction of an inch, you step away from the model, you take one frame of film, and then you move back. You move the arm again, step away from the model, take one more frame of film. And in that way, similar to cartoon animation, you build up a succession of movements one frame at a time that when the film is later strung together, run on a projector, gives you the illusion of movement.
The way you describe the process, it sounds so complex and so detailed. It makes me wonder why in the movie RoboCop they didn't get a man in a robot suit for ED-209, for the totally mechanized police robot.
Well, one of the reasons why we decided to go with stop-motion animation was because the producer fortunately loves stop-motion animation and is a big fan of the process.
It's interesting you should say that, because when I was watching the movie, I really thought of those scenes as a tribute to King Kong.
Well, we didn't think of it as a tribute to King Kong so much as trying to make the best robot movie that had ever been made. RoboCop itself, the character RoboCop, comes from a tradition of robot suit movies that date back to Fritz Lang's Metropolis, and you can see the C-3PO character in the Star Wars series, and now there's RoboCop, and all of these are built around the human frame foundation for obvious reasons. So we decided very clearly to go with a design, or very early on to go with a design for ED-209 that was, if you looked at it from the side, that was very much like a Z shape. And we wanted it to be very clear that there was no way that a human being could possibly be inside. We wanted it to make a very functional, utilitarian piece of hardware. We conceived of ED-209 as a cross between a lathe and a Mack truck, something that was absolutely efficient, that didn't move until it had to, and didn't have any gratuitous action, that really didn't perform any little character anomalies at all. It was just a very straightforward moving object, and it became very clear that this was the right way to go using stop-motion animation.
What are some of the big differences between how you do stop animation now and how it was done in the early days, in the days that King Kong was shot?
There is virtually no difference. The techniques that we use for RoboCop, even down to the photographic processes, were in many ways identical to the processes that were used on King Kong, and definitely Mighty Joe Young. The equipment that we use, in fact, is equipment that was developed in the 20s. We use old Mitchell high-speed cameras that are very reliable and remarkably well-engineered pieces of machinery. And one of the process projectors or rear screen background projectors that we used was developed for Mighty Joe Young and adapted to work on more current films.
Early on in your career, you did stop-motion animation for Jolly Green Giant and Pillsbury Doughboy commercials. Were those commercials good preparation for the kind of major motion pictures you've since done?
Yeah, I think in general, television commercials were a very good, like high school or junior college course, say, for working in feature films, in that you don't work on projects of long duration. Each commercial would last from, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, depending upon how complicated they were. So you'd be in and out, and you would have accrued a number of different techniques and processes, and also a great deal of experience with working with different types of people.
When you were breaking into the movie industry, did you do any special effects for cheap, low-budget movies, kind of any stupid movies?
Let's see, I worked on one called The Crater Lake Monster in the mid-70s that you probably never saw.
You're right.
Nobody else probably, I don't think they saw it. Then I worked on a Roger Corman project called Piranha that brought together Joe Dante, who has just released Interspace. He's the director of Interspace this summer, and John Davison, who's the producer of RoboCop. That's where I met those two men.
That has a screenplay by John Sayles, I think.
Yes, it does. And we were able to slip some stop-motion animation into that, in addition to a number of visual effects with fish and water. And that was about it. Most of my work had been done in television commercials prior to that time. It was very difficult to get into the motion picture industry because of unions, number one. We were all working non-union at the time. And number two, no one was making science fiction-oriented films until Lucas cracked the nut with Star Wars.
So there was not much call for stop-motion work in films for a while?
No, there was literally zero. I mean, there might have been, at least in the L.A., contingency of stop motion animation, there might have been like one or two films made over a 20-year period.
Was there no stop motion animation because the process had gone out of favor, or because those kinds of movies weren't being made?
I think a bit of both. No one had really handled the subject matter to any compelling degree at all, and I think that was one of the problems. The process was stuck with the stigma of not being any good, because the films that they were in weren't any good until George Lucas and Steven Spielberg came along and showed that it was possible to make engaging or entertaining movies using visual effects.
Filmgoers nowadays assume that anything is possible through special effects, and it looks so easy when you're just watching it on screen. Is that ever frustrating for you?
Well, it can be frustrating. It really depends on the approach that one takes. If you're working in the context of a low-budget film, you're very limited to certain processes, and when you're doing that, there are certain things that you can't do, and you have to adhere very, very carefully to certain rules, as we did in RoboCop. When Paul Verhoeven, the director, and I first got together, we spent hours and hours and hours going over the limitations of the process until Paul understood how he could make the limitations work for him dramatically.
Phil Tippett did the stop-motion animation for the movie RoboCop. He spoke to us from NPR station KQED in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up on the program today?
Well, a major stumbling block to disarmament has been removed. West Germany has agreed to phase out missiles designed to carry U.S. nuclear warheads. We'll have a story on that. Also, the Saturday night massacre. Nina Totenberg looks back at the infamous firing of the special prosecutor in the Watergate case and the role played by Judge Robert Bork in that firing. And we'll have a piece on Friday night movie openings.
That's interesting. Every place I've lived in, movies used to open on Wednesdays.
Well, they still do, but they're also opening more and more on Friday nights, and we'll tell you why tonight.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, has just returned from a vacation in France. He brought back some new ideas, which he'll share with us over the next few weeks. Today, a trip to a museum where he found the perfect show for a linguist.
The longest lines in Paris this summer are outside the new D'Orsay Museum, housed in a remodeled railway station on the Quai d'Orsay on the left bank. Most of the people are there to see a stunning permanent collection of 19th century French art. But I slipped away from the crowds in the Impressionist and Post-Impressionist galleries in order to visit a delightful exhibition called The Century of Dictionaries. Using art and graphics, the show honors the two great French lexicographers of the 19th century, Émile Littré and Pierre Larousse, whose name has become a synonym for dictionary in the French language. Now, an Englishman or American might wonder what a show about dictionaries is doing in an art museum. It would be hard to imagine the Metropolitan Museum devoting a major show to the influence of Noah Webster, after all. But then, French dictionaries are different from ours because the French don't think of their language the same way we do. English is the language of a number of different nations with distinct characters and national cultures, whereas French is basically the language of a single national civilization, a kind of cultural bouillabaisse where chunks of art, music, fashion, and history float around in a thick linguistic stock. So the French find it hard to imagine that you could learn their language without drinking in the rest of their civilization as well. French dictionaries reflect this attitude. Take the classic five-volume Grand Larousse, which used to sit in state in the floor-to-ceiling bookcases in the study of every traditional bourgeois home. The Grand Larousse is as much an encyclopedia as a dictionary, with much more biographical and cultural information than you'd find in Webster's International. But what's most striking is its extensive use of illustrations. Not just the little figures that our dictionaries squeeze into the margins, but hundreds of full-page lithographs and engravings, many of them adapted from paintings. There are plates showing the history of flags and costumes, the works of the great painters, the battles of Napoleon, the wildflowers of France. As you leaf through the dictionary, you can see why the Musée d'Orsay would find it an appropriate subject for a show, not just because it makes so much use of art, but because it is a museum in its own right, which tries to exemplify all of the things to which the French language has attached a word. In his book, The Words, Jean-Paul Sartre described his childhood discovery of the Grand Larousse in very much the way one might have described a museum visit. The Grand Larousse was everything for me. I would take out a volume at random and place it clumsily on my grandfather's reading stand. I opened it. I took real birds from their nests. I chased real butterflies perched on real flowers. Men and beasts were there in person. The engravings were their bodies. The texts were their souls, their singular essences. There's something very alluring in this. Surely no one ever wrote about the Oxford English Dictionary in such terms of wonder. But it is just too grandiose and too French, this idea of a language as a universal scheme that tags and classifies every object in the world in a vast grammatical system. When I look at the Grand Larousse, I think of what the English writer G.K. Chesterton wrote in his 1903 essay on the painter G.F. Watts. Man knows that there are in the human soul tints more bewildering, more numberless, and more nameless than the colors of an autumn forest. Yet he seriously believes that these things can every one of them, in all their tones and semitones, in all their blends and unions, be accurately represented by an arbitrary system of grunts and squeals.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University.
You're just too marvelous for words, like glorious, glamorous, and that old standby amorous. It's all so wonderful, I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough.
Here's a preview of tomorrow's Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with alto saxophonist Frank Morgan. In the 50s, he was described as an heir to Charlie Parker, but like Parker, he got hooked on heroin. He spent close to 30 years in prison. He's out now and recording again. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album by the go-go group Trouble Funk. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review The Big Easy, starring Dennis Quaid and Ellen Barkin. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.